Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Carvelli, and welcome to the weekly show, Street and Curb. We come to you every half hour at 5 o'clock p.m. Here at the station, and we have practical approaches and practical applications to very complex issues in today's world. We have an interesting topic tonight. We're going to talk about term limits. Did the founding fathers really believe in them? Should we believe in them, and how we can apply them? So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
The way we treat animals affects all of us. Cruelty overseas led to a pandemic, killing a million people. Help us fight back and make a better world for animals and people by visiting AmericanHumane.org and signing our New Deal for Animals.
Welcome back, everyone, to Street and Curb. I'm your host, Steve Carvelli, and I want to take up a topic tonight concerning term limits. It's becoming more and more appropriate to discuss it. A lot of politicians, depending on their situation or where they sit in the aisle in Congress, have taken it up. But term limits seem to be becoming a little more prevalent today. And it's interesting. It goes all the way back, believe it or not, Mike Huckabee, who was a presidential nominee one time back in 2015, kind of expressed some concerns, let's say, about term limits, and most notably about the Supreme Court. This is where it really gets into where most people talk about term limits. Now, it's been limited to the Supreme Court, but today we're going to expand it to limitations for politics, career politicians. But let's go back to what Mike Huckabee said in 2015. He was an ex-presidential nominee. He was the governor of Arkansas. He's a TV huckster supporting some type of vitamin or something I've seen. And he basically said back in 2015 that the founders have never intended to create lifetime irrevocable posts. And he's talking about the Supreme Court. He has an interesting statement. He says, if a president who appoints them can only serve 8 years, the person they appoint should never serve 40. This has never been made sense to me, and it kind of defies logic. It's interesting that he talks about that. He actually referenced the Federalist Papers, which were written by Alexander Hamilton and James Madison and the John Jay guys. He claims that the Federalist Papers supported his view that the nation's founders came close to imposing judicial term limits in the Constitution, and that they could never have imagined that people would want to serve in government for decades. And that's an interesting point that he's making. However, in the Constitution, there is an Article 3. And the Article 3 is kind of a pushback on this type of assessment about, unlimited serving on the Supreme Court. And Article 3 is an interesting aspect to it. It's basically the opening words of the Constitution's Article 3. States with emphasis added that the judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as the Congress from time to time ordain and establish. The judges, both of the Supreme and inferior courts, shall hold their offices during good behavior. And this is interesting because there seems to be an approach that good behavior means they could hold their offices indefinitely as long as they were behaving well. Now, again, we go to the definition of good behavior, because every door that we kind of shut that we have analyzed, it opens another window. So what is good behavior? Now, the phrase good behavior seems to imply that there is no limit on how long a justice may serve once approved for serving the court. The implication is that you can remove these people for bad behavior through impeachment. So the president, the vice president can be removed from office by impeachment, and so can the Supreme Court. But it can only happen if they were convicted of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. This is an interesting aspect to itself, so that what other things constitute good behavior. So those are bad behaviors. Of course, treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors seem to be kind of like the death knell for your career if you're in politics. But maybe not in today's presidential election. But, back in the founding fathers, they viewed these as high crimes. So again, what constitutes good behavior? Now, I would say and make the assessment that it is broader right now. We have a lot of types of crime that occurs that maybe the founding fathers didn't know about, and namely would be cybercrime. We didn't have anything back in the founding fathers with regards to the internet and cybercrime, but cybercrime is out there. digital crime, embezzlement that happens digitally and online. These are types of crimes that didn't exist back in the Founding Fathers, but exist today. If a judge or someone was doing something on the cybercrime aspect, would that constitute such type of bad behavior? And also in regards to misinformation, is that considered a bad behavior issue? So that's an issue that some of the justices got involved in, hanging the flag upside down, showing something on TikTok. Again, the bad behavior thing is much more broader than it seems to have been back in the day. But I want to take this a little further. And I want to take this to not only the judicial argument about the Supreme Court and term limits. I want to go to the general politics today. Of course, we have term limits on the president. It is two terms, but there is no limitation that the president can't run again. Grover Cleveland did it in one. Donald Trump's trying to do it also. Now, the founders were certainly aware of the political issues with career politicians. They kind of learned from Britain, and Britain at the time in the mid-1700s had a lot of career politicians that they viewed as oppressors, and that's why they founded the new country over here to broaden their scope. So the founders were aware of career politicians, and I'll show you a couple examples. Section 5 of the Virginia Declaration of Rights in June of 1776, they're talking about the separate powers of the legislature and executive powers. And it states the members of the first two may be restrained from oppression by feeling and participating in the burdens of the people. They should at fixed periods be reduced to private station and returned to the body from which they were taken. Section 6 of the Pennsylvania Declaration of Rights back in the mid-1700s was referring to this oppression of people in power too long. And again, proposes to periodically retake public officers and reduce them to the private station from which they came. And not to be outdone, Massachusetts in 1780, Constitution that was written by John Adams, and Section 8 of Declaration of Rights, again, to prevent those who are vested with authority from becoming oppressors, people have a right to cause their public offices to return to public life. So this was certainly on the mind of the Founding Fathers about career politicians. It was identified in multiple cases in multiple states prior to the Constitution, and it was certainly a concern because they learned from what was happening in Britain. And it's interesting that they used the term oppression to outline a little bit about the career politicians. So we're going to take a quick break in here right now. When we come back, we're going to talk about more about career politicians and the, quote, oppression, unquote, that they may exert over people. But we have a lot to talk about. We'll take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Think you're getting chemical poisoning, food poisoning? Call the Poison Helpline first for fast, free advice from medical professionals. Call 1-800-222-1222 anytime, anywhere. Save the number, save a life. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Welcome back, everyone, to Street and Curb. And tonight's topic is oppression and how career politicians can possibly exert that just because they're career politicians. And it's really relevant today because we have a couple. We have one career politician running for president, again, as an incumbent. We have a lot of politicians in this country that seem to be career. Nancy Pelosi, some of the people who are in the new geriatric House and Senate who are in their 70s and 80s, who have been serving for years and years and years. Joe Biden is a career politician, has been in Congress for 30 to 40 years in some capacity or another. And the curious term to me and the operative term to me is the term oppression, that they view that people who are career politicians have the ability to oppress a minority and oppress a minority who is not in power. So I guess the question today is, do career politicians create a form of oppression that by the very nature of it should be overthrown and the resistance should be really given to prevent some that oppression? So I guess the issue is, what is the power of incumbency? Because incumbency, by definition, is a career politician. And if you look at the Senate and you look at the Congress and how people have been running over and over again and winning over and over again, and even in certain states and jurisdictions, a particular party has been in power that long. And that is a power of incumbency also, that the power never changes. When you look at states and cities, particularly like New York and Baltimore and even Washington and Philadelphia, that are perennially Democrat from every level, from the mayorship on down, and even when they run for office, even if there's a kind of a primary on the Democratic side, it just means that whoever wins the primary wins the general election. And that is a little disconcerting, that one party rule can also fall into a career party rule that I think we should actually lump into this discussion about career politicians. So we're going to, from this point on, we're going to consider our conversation going on from career politicians and career parties and how they may create an impression of what the founding fathers would do about it. So let's go over what the power of incumbency does. Number one is fundraising. It is obvious that fundraising is easier when you're an incumbent. Why? Because the people who helped get you in office before contributing benefited in some way of your incumbency, and it behooves them, I like that term, that they would benefit you again by contributing to your reelection. So again, fundraising becomes easier because you have the ability to go back to the people who put you in power in the first place and say, look, if you like me then, you should like me now, because everything will continue the way it is. There is the power of the pulpit, that you get better press coverage as an incumbent because you hold political office. And even though you may mix the differences between running for office and operating an office, you still get the power of the pulpit and you still get the power of the press covering you as an office holder that they generally would have to do. So in two levels, you have a better fundraising capability, you have a better power of the pulpit, you have a better press capability. You also have a mantle of invincibility. Now, what do I mean by that? This is an example that I want to, just in the latest election, AOC, who was running for office in sections of the Bronx in New York and who is a Democratic Socialist, she refused to even acknowledge that she was even had a Democratic opponent in the primary, who was an ex-Wall Street banker. She refused to debate him. She refused to acknowledge him. As a matter of fact, she even appeared at another squad member's election campaign issue, who actually lost, and kind of made it her issue to deal with him because she just kind of ignored her opponent. So there is an invincibility when you're elected, especially to the House for every 2 years, and you get in, you never acknowledge a primary opponent or let alone a general election component. And in her case in New York, which, you know, the Republican Party will, you know, do the latest sacrificial lamb to come up against her, that she'll win again with a limited number of votes and a limited number of jurisdictions and demographics and, you know, keep staying in power. So there is a invincibility that creates, that marginalizes other candidates and opinions, not only within their party who are running to them as a primary, but also against the general public and the opposition. So again, we have fundraising, we have power of the pulpit, we have marginalization of other candidates and opinions, and also special interest keep incumbents in place because of the fundraising, because it benefits them. It is a, you know, the power of the incumbency is dramatic, it's palpable, and it kind of reasserts itself at every election cycle. So anyone going against it really has to be able to commandeer fundraising, has to be able to resonate a message, and maybe has to run on one topic or one issue alone to kind of galvanize their constituency to vote against the incumbency. And if you look at the last election cycle, the amount of incumbents that win is significantly higher than the amount of newcomers that come in. So unless there is something from the top down coming on how people play the tickets or split tickets, it's generally difficult to dislodge an incumbent. So again, is this a representation shortcoming that the founding fathers kind of viewed that was going to happen, but didn't really codify it in the Constitution, but mentioned it in a lot of pre-Constitution declarations? Or is it something that we have kind of magnified today to make it a bigger problem than it actually is? So again, I am a firm believer in term limits. I am a firm believer that the when you come from a private station to public office, it is temporary. It is a service. It is not a career, and it is not a permanent job. So again, why isn't the press or the public pushing back a little bit on this type of career politician? Well, I think it all depends on the party that you work with. The press, you know, I think should have been all over and justifiably so Joe Biden for continuing to run as for president, and just as they're on Donald Trump for running as president, but they're not. And it's kind of an issue that maybe we should discuss a little bit. And how this is really present is how we treat third parties. Third parties in this country, and I mentioned this on previous weeks, the role of the third party has been to act as a spoiler and not as a viable choice for the constituents to make in regards to any office. Sometimes the third party will win local elections because it is hyper-local and the issues are very limited to a very certain demographic and geography that has a little more hands-on approach to how they vote. And it also has limited voting. And in other words, if it's just a local election, the turnout is generally not as great as for a general election. So you get the power of the numbers that can work for someone going against an incumbent that they wouldn't necessarily work on a regional, state, or national level. But again, when it comes back to the third parties, it's interesting because, we have RFK running as a third party. He has been kind of ostracized by Democrats. He has been sometimes embraced by Republicans because they view him as a spoiler to take votes from Biden. But it's interesting because just a couple of days ago, a New Jersey election attorney is trying to kick him off the ballot in New Jersey, claiming that there is a little used law and a little used connection to a law called the sour loser rule that he lost in one election and now he's trying to run as an independent or a Democrat. So this is he's claiming that he's not being paid by any election staff, but he's clearly trying to affect an election by throwing RFK off the ballot. And on both sides, depending on how the voting and the polling goes, if more people think he's taken from Joe Biden, then the Joe Biden camp is going to pressure RFK to, modify his positions or drop out. And the same is true for the Republicans. Whatever the pollsters say that he's taking votes from, is that the party that really wants to get him kicked out? So we have not only oppression that may be enacted by the incumbency, that we have a suppression of third parties in this country because of this. So again, third party candidates, to be viable in this country, have to have an assumption that they are running to win, not running to siphon votes off, not running to create a conceptual message. You have to run to win. You have to be able to not be concerned on how you're going to divert votes, but how you're going to earn them. So you have to run on principle, you have to run on a platform, and you have to run on a non-spoiler type of status. Now, both parties, as I mentioned, are guilty of pressuring third-party candidates, and they have been doing it for a while. The last really viable third-party candidate we had was Ross Perot, and he was a viable third-party candidate. But in all election cycles, if this is the election cycle that we should probably have a third party, it is this one, or at least a viable regional party candidate that can, work in five or six states. But again, it's interesting that we talked about oppression for career politicians because how they can use their authority incumbency to further enact their staying in power. But also there is a suppression issue that I want to discuss. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the power of incumbency and how it works, not only with oppression, but suppression and what it means going forward and how we can kind of take the country back from this oppressive two-party rule we have here and kind of maybe come up with a pathway to move forward. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Kelsey Grammer. Wounded Warrior Project supports injured veterans by connecting them with fellow warriors, by serving them through mental health and wellness programs, and by empowering them to live on their own terms. No one should face a battle alone. Join us at woundedwarriorproject.org.
Welcome back, everyone, to Street and Curb. I'm your host, Steve Carvelli, and you join us every week at 5 o'clock, where we talk politics, we talk common sense answers, pragmatic answers, to our complex issues. Today, we're talking about term limits, career politicians, what it means for us, what it meant for the founding fathers, and I guess the power of career politicians. There is a sense of greed, there is a sense of invincibility, and there is a sense that bad behavior can not only maybe be conducted, but also be hidden from the general public if they are career politicians long enough. Career politicians seem to be able to develop their own infrastructure within the government. They develop their own power of invincibility and keeping their power and keeping their fundraising going. So there is a kind of geritocracy or a geriatric class that I think has been developing. I don't think this country needs a lot of 70 to 80 year old politicians running the country. It is good in the sense that perhaps they served in the military in a major war in this country that gives them an additional experience. However, the institutions itself, I don't think were ever meant for career politicians, and they should be put back in the public stock when impossible. But I want to talk a little bit about misinformation and what's happening today on how it's viewed. Was posed to me the other day, can an incumbent president have that much power to really impose limits on free speech and who reports it? And I, up until probably, and I've debated this back and forth, but just recently, yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled that in favor of the Biden administration, but Samuel Alito wrote a scathing rebuke to it and a rebuttal to it. Basically, it was kind of a situation in which the Supreme Court stated that the certain governors and certain attorney generals of conservative states did not have the power or the standing to contest a Biden administration rule that somehow gives the Biden administration power over independent third-party private entities on what type of information they report. And this mainly came up during COVID. And it's a situation in which misinformation or what the administration viewed as misinformation should be restricted from third-party websites, newspapers, digital platforms that they viewed as misinformation about COVID. Now, it's interesting why they use COVID. COVID didn't have a lot of information on it, or what was considered misinformation perhaps was a little fuzzy and got confused with what is considered factual. So COVID was something new, and there was probably a lot of misconceived ideas about. It wasn't necessarily gone up to the point of misinformation that needed to be regulated. So the Supreme Court ruled that the conservative attorney generals in those states did not have the standing to bring this case. So it allowed the Biden administration to get away with regulating information and how it's distributed on the internet to the general public in situations that it seems to deem necessary. So misinformation, again, we're always into this information. Everyone talks about it. Everyone has an opinion on it. Who determines it? Why do they determine it? Is it a consensus? Is it a vote? And why does the misinformation have to be struck from the internet, has to be struck from print, because it's good for the nation? Again, it goes back to the issue that we have politicians and parties in control for a period of time that marginalizes opposition and marginalizes other opinion that doesn't want that to be viewed. It just so happens that the minority party in power had a different opinion about COVID, and there were some wild theories and wild conspiracy theories out there that were online, and the government wants to suppress not only them, but maybe a consenting opinion that may be different from what the consensus opinion is in the ruling incumbency. And that's the issue. I think we fought the war against Britain to free ourselves from that. I think that the general public, it goes back to the assumption that the parties in power view that the general electorate is not educated enough and doesn't know better enough to separate themselves from fact or fiction and what they want to believe and not want to believe in. I mean, there is fraud committed every day online, and there is gullible people who go for it every day and give their money to overseas and contribute to something overseas and never get their money back, crypto being a perfect example of this. But there is nothing at stake that you can do anything to that factor. So it's an interesting thing. I'm not sure how we go forward on this, but we're going to take a quick break and when we come right back, we'll kind of bring this to a little bit of a conclusion and see where we can kind of at least get some common ground so we can go forward.
Hi, I'm Connie Britton for Feeding America, because they help provide over 6 billion meals to people in need each year. Learn more at feedingamerica.org. Feeding America, 200 food banks strong.
Welcome back, everyone, to Street and Curve. I'm your host, Steve Carvelli, and we thank you, everyone, for joining us today. And, of course, we're tackling some subjects that are going to get a lot of discussion coming up in this election cycle. We have career politicians. We have the power of incumbency. We have geriatrics who perhaps may have some physical impairments running for office again. And then we have, of course, the whole spin on misinformation and who's doing it, who should control it, and why us as American citizens should be subject to a authority above us that somehow regulates the information we get and how we interpret that information. There used to be a very old saying. I hate to stereotype people in this world, but there's three people and three types of people in the world. They're the ones who tell a story. There are ones who believe in the story, and there is the 1% who always question the story. And, you know, when we talk about the 1% in this country, that is maybe the 1% we should strive to be. Not that we, just question everything for the sake of questioning or just be disagreeable for the sake of being disagreeable. But, you know, stories, I think that we are smart enough in this country, the electorate, is knowledgeable and can make the decisions on their own. And I talk more about the independent thought process rather than the groupthink thought process that kind of governs the information we do in. So I guess when the founding fathers put the Constitution together, they kind of knew that no matter how we evolve as a society with technology or whatever, there's going to be issues and there's going to be oppression issues and suppression issues. And they may have used language that's a little different than what we're used to now. But I think the founding fathers and the founding people in this country were really smarter than us. And that's why the Constitution endures. I think that a lot of the revisionism and how we want to make the Constitution work for our belief systems now is really what they were guarding against. But, you know, we're going to have to wait and see. I mean, we've had a country for over about 240, 250 years. We'll have to see if we can get through another 50 years or we can just get through this election cycle. So that's it for me today. I welcome everyone who joined us today for Street and Curb. We're coming back at you next week, same time, same place, same channel. And we'll see you then. Take care. Pay attention to the candidates. Pay attention to the debates and make an informed decision. So we'll see you next week.